interrupting the current neo-Euchronial climate-challenged, behaviorally controlled, energy-starved, alien-invaded, nuclear-glowing, postulated cricketism to bring you behind the woodshed. This is Cricketude Busting Episode BTWRLM 633. And remember, being free is not a spectator sport. You have to get involved. But you're going to be involved. And it's your choice on what you decide that involvement's going to be. So make the switch and get you behind the woodshed. For that dose of reality. Hopefully you're giving it. Because you can't go wrong when you get behind the woodshed. Be that example as well. Just talking about Russia's Sberbank launching their Bitcoin-linked bonds last episode and the Russian consumer credit ban the episode before that. Things are transforming very quickly in Russia. Remember, I talk about the things out there because they're actually happening right over here. Where is there in here? Wherever you is. Pretty simple. It's global, don't you know? The sustainable trap here is being sprung upon, but apparently transparent to those Russian people. Because I don't hear a peep from the Russian people in objection at all. And it's a little bit of a shame. You can hear me say certain things in favor of what's going on to protect the people in Ukraine that Russia is doing. You have always heard me say and have an objection to what they're doing to the people of Russia and relative to the global impositions. Maybe the Soviet is too familiar to the Russians to notice the dangers, I suspect. And this is partly how I was able to identify it. When you understand about property and you understand about the government's obligation to protect that, then there's no duty in the cops to protect you. There's an obligation in property law about grantor protecting its grants. And this is where we kind of get the start of all this. And that's the government handing the property over for the best uses that the land of our is put to by law and then accepted by people who do that work on the land to produce from the land. So until you see some of that basis for what's going on, the extra stuff that goes on, the esoteric, satiricide, intangible things kind of get past us. And that's what this sustainable development thing is, and that's exactly what we're talking about here as they bring in the Siberian Gulag. Russia to mandate now state-backed digital ID app on all devices. The government-mandated super app looms over Russia's smartphones, folding daily life into the state's digital reach. Under a new mandate set to take effect on September 2025, all smartphones, tablets, and similar devices sold in Russia will be required to come preloaded with a state-backed digital identity platform. Let me interject that. I hadn't thought about it until I just read that again. Remember the UPC codes, these QR codes they want to use? Well, the UPC code, is going. This new thing commoditizes everything. And when I was reading the list of the smartphones and the tablets and similar devices, remember the internet battlefield of things, all these so-called smart, not too intelligent, but SMART, devices are interlinked and they can be identified. And remember all the censoring that's in those devices or can be, as I've talked over the years to bring this stuff out. Here it is right now being wrapped all together in this story right here, right, coming down on Russia. And I told you, watch it, watch how they're coming down. It's coming a lot faster than everybody thought. And again, the Russian people apparently are oblivious to this, like most people would be here in the United States. I think they are, mostly. We have a little bit different framing, though. But this is an all-in-one application. The all thing. The everything. Right? The everything app. Remember, who have we heard that before? I'm going to get to that in the area in, I think. There's another company out there, too. This all-in-one application designed to consolidate government services, financial tools, messaging, and digital identification into a single interface, significantly expanding the role of state-linked software in everyday life. The Russia State Duma passed the enabling legislation last week outlining plans to consolidate public sector utilities and commercial services within the new platform. Understand what they're wrapping up here. As we talked and listened, this is just the nuisance to us. The law also specifies that the project must be assigned to a domestic company with an established user base exceeding 500,000 daily active users, entities that, under existing rules, are obliged to censor and monitor content. Let me interject on this quickly. This is what part of the idea I had a long time ago, and we've talked at reallibertymedia.com and sound, putting all together, getting some of the people in the background, the coders, to understand as we've been moving this thing along, that we have to, if you will, I'll use the word federate, but it's because it's a common understanding, federate our efforts so that we never, you'll always notice a number, a maximum number, a minimum number before it attaches. This is almost everything ever noticed. And so they put these on there. If we can maintain the content provisions that always stay at a minimum level, that each one of us carries some of the load, we'll never reach these minimums as a regulable body, if you will. There's no body. And this is part of one of the little bitty secrets. I don't talk too much about it. I might have made a mention to behind the scenes of what I see needs to be done. And this is what we're trying to do at Real Liberty Media. In other words, Real Liberty Media, if it ever would get the following and get as very popular, we could be walking into that. But if we all had a federated existence and actually the listener actually chooses, there's really no sourcing from it. And so it's a little different approach. What I've had, this idea about this is now brought up in this 500,000 daily active users. You have a system that doesn't have those users or can be found as one group. You can avoid the regulation. And I've talked to you over a year, a decade and a half, relative to the Matrix is not a movie, how the underground works, the sewers, how you have to be there. You can still be found out, but there's certain rules that you're just invisible. You're just not part of it. And here, this is in that paragraph right there. So what we're doing at Real Liberty Media, and hopefully it comes along and gets done, is we make and establish something that can function where everybody, all the bigger folks are regulated. We're not. We still get to pass content. So we'll stop there because there's really not much more to talk about until we get things going. You could help to that effort. Donate to reallibertymedia.com. Find the donate buttons and do what you can. And again, we're all still looking. It's not just cash. Cash is going to be great because it takes a lot. It's surprising how much money it costs on the backside, behind the woodshed, exposed to have to come up with in order to keep things functioning and advance. But content providers, those of you that have content, you've gotten behind the woodshed yourself, you have something you've been knowing for a long time, bring it to sound and set yourself up a place on the schedule. State Duma Information Policy Committee Chair Sergey Boyarsky described the app as a step toward reinforcing national control over digital infrastructure. And I want, again, this is going to maybe take a little bit longer. I don't want to go too deep on it, but all these words are very important. As I read these things, I'm seeing other stories of other things that were going on. Remember, I highlight the word infrastructure a lot, like we do many other words as well. But it's national control and infrastructure as they're building. It's not anything different than Trump's allowing and promoting right now. So if you think it's over there, please re-gauge what's going on in the world and watch. As I talk over there, it's happening ahead of time. We can see what's happening here or to come. The government's vision, how many times do we see these words, folks? It's all built into sustainable development goals. Everyone, I don't know, not everybody, lots of people just want to know. They've heard it so much, they want to hear it. This is being built right into your societies. You don't even know it. It's transparent to you. How many times have I said that for you? Government's vision for the platform extends far beyond basic communication. I'll bet. Individuals would be able to verify their age at retail locations, check into accommodations, access student discounts, improve eligibility for social services, all without needing physical documentation. Transactions involving property, vehicles, or banking could also be handled through the app's secure ID and signature capabilities. Although the project's official overseer has not yet been named, VKontakte, the company operating Russia's most used social network, is considered the lead candidate. Digital Development Minister Maksut Shadayev highlighted VKontakte's recent development of a new app called Max, which merges chat features, voice calling, app integration, and payments. Developers have already expressed intentions to connect it with official government platforms, or I suppose they don't get any business. That's how easy this is going to be. It's really the bottom line. Some officials have And I get energetic. Every time I think, my mind's going 1,000 different areas. When I start talking, I've got my mind going lots of areas. This is also the problem with the having finances and fiscal stuff and having money and getting money, is that it's all tied to those fiat papers, all that instruments that they use, the government prints and controls. And so it becomes important to see how well this is going to be integrated for those of us trying to keep a low profile, what they're integrating into the future and what gets taken away from us as we move into that future, that brave new world, they want to call it, that Siberian gulag. When I say Siberian here, I'm not talking about Russia and Siberia. But it looks the same. Soviet, it all looks the same when you get going with it. So some officials have compared the forthcoming system to China's WeChat. First Deputy Chair Anton Gorelkin acknowledged the similarity, describing it as a domestic version of Tencent's Everything app, which combines messaging, transportation payments, and other services into one ecosystem. So you think sustainable development is talking about ecosystem? No, this is the infrastructure they're talking about for control, the prison walls. So did you hear that, Elon? Hey, someone's beat you to that Everything app you intended for ex-Twitter. That comparison, however, has fueled unease among observers concerned about government overreach. Well, it's not bad enough they got you tapped into everything you do in your life. Oh, it's overreach now. No, see, it's not. Once you're involved, it's not overreach. You've agreed to every bit of it. The independent outlet Medusa noted that the project raises alarms over surveillance and content control, especially given VKontakte's long-standing ties with Russian authorities. Let me offer, that's why I talk behind the woodshed on this stuff. They're talking about it happening right on their, it's on their neck in September. I'm saying, look, it's not here yet. Get involved and shut it down for yourself. Shut this stuff down. Find alternatives that we're going to continue to move through. This is a warning to us. Officials continue to frame the initiative as a convenience for citizens, promising tighter integration with Gosuluji Portal and a more streamlined way to interact the public institution. Gosuluji, if you take a little bit of letter, looks like gulag to me, but that's up to you to see. Maybe a little dyslexic anymore, but there it is, the gulag portal right there, built right into that name, I think. Yet the move also represents a dramatic consolidation of data, identity, digital communications under state oversight, reviving long-standing privacy concerns in the country where centralized digital control has been steadily expanding. So here we have there, I don't know what their government structure really is, but they have people that are concerned, but it doesn't matter. See, the state's going to have their way. Going to have their way with you, and we're going to have what appears to be partly and mostly the Palantir Panopticon or the Stargate by Oracle, and Trump's okay with all that, especially now that he got into crypto, right? So the National Siberian Gulag is not going to be just in Siberia. We can see the correlation right here at home and just about everywhere else. Anywhere that's going to have the internet is going to have this. And apparently, to not be outdone, but going at it backwards now, we're going to get jump back over here. Senate pushes bill that could end private messaging. Encrypted platforms could become collateral damage. Unintended consequences, I suppose they'll call them. Collateral damage to the legislative push that treats privacy itself as a liability. Again, this is back in the United States now. So if you keep track of how they're doing this, you don't have the privacy inside that app in Russia. They're just going to get rid of that privacy right up front, right here in America. So we don't have to worry about it. And that's really what this aged identification nonsense is all about. They get you inside to have to start IDing yourself, and then it really doesn't matter. You can have encryption, but they know who you is. Under the euphemism of strengthening measures against child exploitation online, a controversial Senate bill is resurfacing with provisions that privacy advocates say would gut critical internet protections and compromise the security and privacy of all citizens. Well, there won't be any. Again, they don't have to give you privacy if everybody's a government property. And if you go look in the United States Code, you'll find it. If those of you that done the study, you've seen it. the person subject to the United States is a property of the United States. People don't quite get this. It's right there printed. And it's been like that for decades and decades and decades. As I explained to you, your civil rights are extortions of every kind. Most people don't even go check that. Those that have are astonished, and they just sit there and realize, wow, maybe there's a reason why we're all beat up and beat down and not having much more than the extortion put on us. So there's major fundamental changes that have to be made by we the people if we're going to maintain, get back to some form of being free, and that the government serve us again. They're serving us, so they're serving us up is what they're doing. Lysander Spooner may be somebody you might want to read about who, in my mind, understood this very, very well. Used to talk a lot more about him a long time ago. I haven't talked about him at all in recent many years. He's a character back there in the past. It's funny what you see all these shipping issues going on now. FedEx and UPS and all those. That's what he was doing early on, and he got beat up for that, but he still pressed it. And every time they beat him up, he was outspoken about it. Known as the Stop CSAM Act of 2025, it's Senate Bill 1829, for those of you that may want to track this down and go after it to help eliminate it. The legislation is being criticized for using broad language and vague legal standards that could severely weaken encryption and open the floodgates for content takedowns, including legal content, across a wide range of online services. The bill's stated aim is to curb the spread of child sexual abuse material, a crime already strictly prohibited under federal law. Current regulations already compel online platforms to report known instances of such material to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, which coordinates with law enforcement. I read that, folks, in my study, that documentary I wanted to do way back in 2023. I started doing the research. I think I came onto it in 2023 about your child services, your state child welfare services that are going on. Yeah. They're not calling on themselves, I can tell you that. And so I've talked about that. I won't do that here, but there's another cancer going on that's finally being exposed with this Epstein nonsense and all that other thing that's going on. But you'll notice also, as I want to remind us here, when you hear the stories about the big busts that are going down, the big pedophile busts, look how many judges and lawyers are there, and you'll find likely zero. And that's a whole group of people that are likely doing things. And I say that from experience in looking at the documentary, the information and the facts I was building to build the documentary that got me in a lot of trouble back then. In fact, I told you before, anybody who's listened to me, you've heard me say, I'm probably very fortunate to be alive today, because there's anybody that's tracked that down, that found it out and started tracking that down is dead. In fact, someone who followed almost my exact steps, he was an FBI investigator, he's dead. So there's a real systemic cancer about that. And here we see this right here. Current regulations already compel online platforms to report instances of such material to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, but you won't hear that from the state governments to that place, that's for sure. And the euphemism called runaways. Yeah, right. However, S1829 goes well beyond the existing mandate, targeting a wide spectrum of Internet platforms with new forms of criminal and civil liability that could penalize even the most privacy-conscious and appliance services. And this is where we start creeping into, doesn't have a 500,000 user base. This is just starts creeping into just about everywhere, doesn't it? And so you see the adjustment being done here, and it envelops everybody. The scope of the legislation is sweeping. Its provisions apply not only to large social media platforms, but also the private messaging apps, cloud storage services, and email providers. By introducing new crimes related to hosting or facilitating of exploitative content, using legal terms with unclear bounds, the bill places encrypted platforms at significant risk. Under the bill's loose definition, simply providing a secure, privacy-focused service could be interpreted as facilitating illegal activity, regardless of whether the provider can access or verify content being transmitted. So anybody who's been looking at this, look at that paragraph very carefully on how they're shifting the goalpost a bit in order to get at you, essentially. This is especially dangerous for services that implement end-to-end encryption, a core feature designed to keep users' communications secure from both hackers and unauthorized surveillance. Because such platforms cannot access user content, they could face liability for material they neither see nor control. Even a notice alleging the presence of CSAM could be enough to meet the bill's threshold for knowledge, exposing providers to prosecution or lawsuits without concrete evidence. They complain about lawfare, but here is written right into these bills now through this Siberian gulag. Remember, as a prisoner, as a token citizen, you won't have any rights. You're a trustee waiting to be caught. If the Stop CSAM Act becomes law, many platforms may adopt invasive scanning out of fear, not necessarily just to avoid liability, with real consequences for privacy and user trust. Equally alarming is the bill's attempt to rewrite Section 230, a foundational law that protects platforms from being sued over user-generated content. By creating a new exemption for civil claims tied to alleged facilitation of CSAM, the bill paves the way for lawsuits targeting online intermediaries for speech they didn't create and cannot always monitor. In the absence of Section 230 protections, many platforms may default to aggressive moderation, suppressing lawful expression to avoid potential legal troubles. The fallout would not be limited to bad actors. Everyday users could find their posts deleted, their accounts suspended, or the access to the communication tools blocked, not because their content is illegal, but because the platforms fear liability. And I'm going to say right here, it's happening to me just now, in the last few days. It's not that my content is illegal at all. It's just that there's a platform who I guess wants to get in my, ex-Twitter, wants to get in my face and not let me onto the platform. Talk about reach, you can't even get on. And they make all kinds of stupid, dumbest reasons about how the fact is that you can't get in, but you can't get around it. So, this is already happening in different ways. If they don't want you on, they keep you out. Like the Real Liberty Media Network and of syndicators. Now at well over 190 accounts and syndications been taken down from Rumble for no reason. Literally zero communication, just taken down. It's not even put on for maybe a couple hours, and they take down an account that provides the RLM feed to Rumble. So this is already happening here. They're just going to formalize this if people don't start getting involved, rolling up your sleeve, finding some interest in some of these things. Maybe not everybody is interested in this, but you got to find interest in something. There's enough of us with enough things out there that's interesting to roll up your sleeves and help educate those people that are supposedly making law or making law against you, show them how that's not in service to the people. And some of these problems are not so easily fixed, Vince, easily. They're not so simple in the digital realm. And so they're taking the easy way out while we're all silent on it. For many communities, particularly those relying on encrypted services for safety, these regulations threaten not just privacy, but also their ability to speak and organize online. Let me also offer, last episode I think it was, I talked about the fact of encryption allows me to feel better that I'm keeping private what I'm doing. They take away encryption, they take away my ability to say I want my stuff private. See, if it doesn't violate the law, they can't just presume that upon me, or they're not supposed to. I want a way to, the encryption allows me a way to say, no, this is off limits. You need a warrant. And so this is why I'm critical about the ability to have end-to-end encryption or all the certain things that I use to cause us to be anonymous. It's not that I'm doing anything illegal, and you likely aren't either. I want to say that I want my things and what I do private. And that was one way to do that. They take that away. They take away your ability to say no. And there's no crime involved until they find the goods. Moving on to the big story here coming in through the last 2 weeks, and it's coming on to at the end of last week. Just so much to go through. I'm going to touch a light. There's very serious matters in the world, and I'm interested in them because, as I've told you before, as I predicted coming in, old Saint Nick's ear, the assassination attempt of Trump, and the promotion of Iran done it all that week before was essentially a hypnotic programming of Trump, essentially, what I figured. On the outside, unless he was already taken by the inside, which it looks like he might have as well. So he's got a bunch of forces that would direct him to go after Iran. Well, here we are. There really wasn't much to stop that, apparently. Even if neither of those two scenarios are correct, what I came up with to get me to understand in the future we were going to war with Iran, and even outside of what we were told, that there was a plan essentially set up by Satan Yehu to make us go to war. We're here now. The United States is now considering to jump in the fray in the Middle East between Israel and Iran. In 2 weeks. Possibly. And this is the big joke and game that goes on. Israel would have no qualms about a USS Liberty-style false flag if Iran campaign falters, is the title of a report. What am I talking about? The Nimitz is being brought into the Middle East, and next year it's going to go into decommission. It'd be a prime target to put to the bottom of the ocean. Davy Jones' locker will be filled, but that's not beyond the pale for Israel in doing a false flag, what they call the Liberty-style false flag. Donald Trump is mulling whether or not to join Israel's aggression against Iran as Tel Aviv faces problems sustaining its defenses against growing counterstrikes and apparently lacks the realistic game plan for an end of hostilities after failing to achieve its goals. An analyst told Sputnik how the U.S. could be nudged into the conflict. So here's another nudging, this is a sustainable development word. They keep promoting that all the time. So you just watch these words they use. But so let me go back and talk. I told you this Saint Nick Deer would be getting us into Iran if we're not careful, if he's not careful, despite all his, he wants to be a peacemaker statements. But this is what Israel needs to get the United States into the war. And my whole point on that is your loved ones, your sons and daughters are going to be the fodder for this, fighting for Israel. And so this is the danger, though, why I'm even talking about it now. Here we are. I can't believe it. I can't believe this is all this predictable in a way. And yet it is. The U.S. is already assisting Israel with supplies, intel, refueling support, etc. One of the many U.S. posts in the region could be attacked for a casus belli, former Pentagon analyst Karen Kwiatkowski has explained. Quote, if Trump doesn't comply with Israel's demand and join its aggression voluntarily, a false flag may be needed to drag the United States in, Kwiatkowski, retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel turned Iraq war whistleblower, fears. Netanyahu has a diverse array of options at his disposal, according to The Observer, including, let's take a note of these as we go and listen and watch the news this and whether how this is playing out or not. Again, you focus on what's going on in order to track what your expectations of a condition may be. A false flag might be considered against U.S. assets abroad blamed on Iran or of an axis of resistance allies like the Houthis. A U.S. domestic attack or assassination blamed on Iran. Remember again, way back when Trump was campaigning, Iran done it, Iran done it, Iran done it. And I was saying, that's just a setup for the takedown in the future. They've already primed that one. It just didn't happen. Iranian air defenses accidentally hit a civilian jetliner carrying Americans. Use of a dirty bomb or nuclear contamination somewhere in the region blamed on Iran. And what are we hearing in Ukraine? But that's what they've gone to that. They've been going on for over 2 years, a year and a half, claiming, oh, they're going to do a dirty bomb. They're going to attack a nuclear facility, a reactor over there, right? I mean, this is the Israeli playlist. Even blackmailing by threatening to use nukes against Iran if the United States doesn't join the fight. That, I think, just happened today. Kwiatkowski estimates that Israel probably has, quote, enough blackmail power against President Trump and Congress, the compromised Congress critter, to avoid the necessity of a false flag operation, but a, quote, U.S. Liberty-style, unclosed quote, attack targeting the soon-to-be-retired USS Nimitz supercarrier that's heading into the Middle East, for example, nevertheless cannot be ruled out entirely, she says. And I'd like to add and clarify exactly. These are potentials and possibilities. We just look at them, see what's out there. And my main thing when I say that is, do we have a cause to be there? No, we actually don't. And so the false flag is what we're talking about that would give the cover to allow Trump to go in with a clearer mind about, oh, protecting the United States. But I'll tell you, the Nimitz may be at the bottom of the ocean and all those sailors will likely be dead. Beirut-based geopolitics analyst Yagiya Tashigjian agrees, emphasizing that Israel has limited capabilities when it comes to destroying Iran's nuclear infrastructure, the stated goal of Operation Rising Lion, especially the underground nuclear facilities. The same holds true for Israel's lack of ability to independently deploy boots on the ground in Iran, which means no chance of overwhelming victory, even if events go their way in the ongoing back-and-forth strikes. Possible scenarios for a false flag imagined by Tashigjian include, quote, attacking U.S. bases in Iraq or a terror attack against U.S. embassies in the region. And again, not to sound too inflammatory about all this or sensational, the United States has been moving material and people are being removed from Iraq, which I find to be a decent thing. They should have done that a long time ago, but this is limiting the strike capacity so that this can't happen. So this may be inside the administration's contemplations. They're focusing. They're going to have their focusing. When they move those out, then there's only going to be a few more other attacks where a false flag could happen. And that's even actually more manageable in some regard as well. So remember, there is no, though the, all this talk about the nuclear, there's no evidence that Iran has any nuclear weapons and has said it does not intend to build nuclear weapons. In fact, it's religiously prohibited at this point from doing so. However, this may drive them to want to get a nuclear weapon. Now, the latest from the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, has since also refuted Israel's claim, stating that the watchdog has found no evidence that Iran has been making a systematic effort to produce nuclear weapons, which is the latest twist on this whole thing. Oh, they got an effort. Now, it's even worse than that. Tulsi Gabbard said, no, we have no evidence. Well, the CIA has come forward to say, well, we do have evidence. Tulsi made a false report. That's an allegation. So they're built, the CIA is who? We find out since James Jesus, how mind programming was that? James Jesus, Appleton, he helped the Mossad enter in and join up with the CIA. So here we have CIA popping up in the last second to say, oh, no, no, Tulsi just filed a false report. This is the latest of the latest that I can get to you here. It's moving way so fast, though. Anyway, all this stuff is really almost beyond this broadcast, I'll tell you that. It's getting so difficult to try and parse through the most important and then the changing information coming so quickly. And so I have to synthesize that down and try and project that out and find the core so that we can continue looking into the future and not get trapped by the traps, by the things that the system wants us to understand. We have to understand a lot better. So Satan Yehu is continuing the same lie about the WMDs, those weapons of mass destruction, that Satan Yehu has been claiming Iran would make in minutes, being minutes away, always, from having a nuclear weapon since 1995. I guess if you tell the lie long enough, then people will believe it. It's happening right now. Those are the same WMD lies Satan Yehu used to also compromise on the compromised Congress critters and the Republican regime to attack Iraq and furthering the Zionistas' Greater Israel project toward Middle East domination using American blood and treasure and the treasury for through regime changes. And that becomes another thing. Oh, they're not supposed to do that. They don't think, well, that Israel just came up and said they're looking to take out the head Khamenei. But it's not about that. See, so this is how the game gets played. But international law condemns and does not allow for regime change or theft of natural resources as Trump and Israel do right now elsewhere, and Trump admitted doing in Syria. That this is not supposed to be considered. These are considered war crimes when they happen. And these are premeditated at that. And this is the United States Knesset policy of permanent war as a method of governance where leaders no longer see peace as the goal, but war as the mechanism for national unity and political survival. It is consistent with domestic, is inconsistent with domestic and international law. So keep track of where the bouncing ball's going. The bouncing bomb, maybe. The nuclear bomb, as this thing may be playing out. This is what they've been planning the whole time. And this is now coming to fruition. It's not for America. It may be the United States, but it's not for America. So let me also add that almost as consistent as the improperly switching the term nuclear weapons here, they switch that for nuclear program. And so they expand the focus when they shouldn't actually be doing it. It's not true that civilian use of nuclear material is limited to the 3.75% enrichment that Trump said he had gotten them. But Iran appears to have successfully and apparently revolutionarily created a radiopharmaceutical industry whose medical enrichment needs are 60%, though well short of nuclear weapons needs. And so you look at what Iran's doing, the holding back to 3.75% actually destroys an industry that Iran does apparently very well. When you look through, it's pretty amazing what they've done with these radiopharmaceuticals and what they've been able to create from this technology. And that needs at least a 60% enrichment. They can't really not do enrichment if they want to keep their radiopharmaceutical products. Well, that becomes what? That becomes clearly is going to be a product of competition, isn't it? So it can't be said, like some deceptive politics, that Iran's civil enrichment needs are not even the 3.75 needed for power reactors because it can purchase that elsewhere and does not need to enrich. So who are these people that dictate Iran's nuclear materials needs? Again, we're talking the difference between nuclear weapons, which are prohibited or need to be regulated, and just nuclear projects. And why the need that these bald-faced liars have making flip-flopping, unqualified assertions in doing so to justify unwarrantable interference or war crimes, J.D. Vance. You're now prominent in the news about this, promoting it all. And I just saw an ex-Twitter feed a couple days ago. He pushes a whole bunch of stuff together. He should be limited to 288 characters and then discuss it. He pushes a whole bunch of stuff that's not provable by him and can be found other way reasons and have other proofs. And yet he uses all that to press upon people that he's right. Trump's right. And it's completely antagonistic to international law. It's an assault on international norms that all the rest of the globe works by. This is all, again, lying in order to support Israel, which is just another liar, a deceiver. I've talked about these guys so many years ago, I can't remember. And upon the real reason the chosen Zionist regime is attacking Iran in furtherance of its greater Zionism project to dominate everyone, including Christians, in the Middle East. We think it's all just these Arabs, these Muslims. No, there's lots of people of different faiths in that region. Israel has no right to force regime change in Iran, as stated by Zakharova, press minister at Russia. Again, other elements, all these elements coming together, they're all wrongs. We're not, again, let me just offer it in support here. We're talking international law comparisons. So this is, we're not just talking somebody's opinion. This is the same thing I did by why I read the belligerent occupier section of the international law relative to what Israel's rights are and what relative to what the Palestinians' rights are in Palestine. Okay, this is not my opinion. I want people to see the black and white. She's going to be talking here. The regime changes off limits completely. And you're going to hear that them, the United States and Israel, and you say, oh, we're not going to do regime change. But that's exactly what they're coming out to do. In other words, you might as well just take the 180-degree view of what they're saying, take the other opposite way, and you'll be probably fine to understand exactly what they're going to do. It's another form of deny, deny, deny. But then you act. And they work on whether or not you can get remedy from that. But as I said, they go after the Nimitz on a false flag, all your sailors are dead. Or most, a lot of them. And I don't know how many are on that ship, but I've heard up to 5,000 or 6,000 people. That's a decent-sized city floating around. And don't underestimate these hypersonic weapons. I've been reading quite a bit. They can't be stopped. They're being stopped by accident. So Israel has no right to force regime change. Israel has no justification for trying to bring about regime change in Iran through its bombing campaign. Russian Foreign Minister spokeswoman Maria Zakharova told RT's Rick Sanchez on Wednesday. West Jerusalem backers conveniently forget about the legal and moral principles they claim to defend the moment they're called upon to support the Jewish state, she stated. Israel launched a series of missile attacks against Iran on Friday, claiming that Tehran was on the brink of acquiring nuclear weapons, a goal Tehran has repeatedly denied pursuing. The Islamic Republic responded with a missile barrage of its own, and the two nations have been exchanging strikes ever since. Quote, what has Iran done wrong? What is it being bombed for? So I'd have to say, yeah, what has the sovereign nation done wrong? And I'll add, what has Iran done worse than the genocide the Zionist regime is committing in Palestine that the United States supports? Quote, Israel says that they don't like the regime in Iran, the political regime, Zakharova said, stressing that this doesn't give West Jerusalem the right to attack another nation. Whether you like a regime or you don't, if it doesn't attack you, you have no right to change that regime, she argued. Iran's nuclear program, so again, follow this difference. This is not nuclear weapons. Iran's nuclear program, which I explained, also includes radiopharmacology. Very interesting stuff they do there. But Iran's nuclear program, which Israel portrays as a source of major concern, is a matter for international law and diplomacy to deal with, the spokeswoman pointed out, adding that any issues linked to it should be resolved by the international community. Quote, it's not a matter of somebody trying to solve this issue on their own, she added. It's exactly what I said the last couple episodes. Again, it's not opinion. I try to, as best as I can, reiterate the fact of the back, black and white, in order for us to better understand an objective basis for when things go wrong, how do you handle them? With all these disparate beliefs and insights and systems. And that's why we say international law, you might as well just move the word law aside and put norms. And this is what all these nations are supposed to be sovereign, and so they all have to make their own decisions, but these are the norms that we would follow in order to get through a problem. And typically it is a problem. Normally we don't have to worry about it when it's not. And on this discussion, there's another thing that I've noticed that isn't talked about relative to international law. Where is it written that the Zionists, or the United States, or any other nation for that matter, has a unilateral right to attack another nation regarding nuclear technology at all? See, it's not in the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. That's not part of it. It's in diplomacy and international regulation. J.D. Vance's word salad attempting to justify his support of the Supreme Commander-in-Chief flip-flopper doesn't hold up relating to that in any regard anyway. And despite any excuse-seeking justification to attack Iran's nuclear materials program, it is being reported that the Pentagon assesses that U.S. bunker busters would not be sufficient to take out Iran's nuclear facility at Fardo without several very, very hard-to-aim strikes at the same precise spot in order to do that. So this may not be, and likely is not, a worthy of any legitimate gamble, if a consideration at all, either, what they're talking about. And there's a whole interesting thing that you get into reading about these bunker buster bombs and what the making of a bunker, the materials that they've been, the science behind all that, the battle between the bunker buster and the material that makes a bunker. Fascinating what they do, what people do to protect themselves and how deep they go. But if that's the fact that the bunker busters can't quite do that job, Thank goodness. We might just have avoided a world war here. Maybe that fact alone required Trump to rethink putting the peacemaker he claims to intend to be back in play, and to exorcise Satan Yehu, then negotiate the permanent peace Trump claims he wants there. Because I know Iran and Russia, if you think about that, with Ukraine being consistent, they have both been interested in stopping the endless wars policy the U.S. seems keen to continue waging. What would we hear that for? For the economics, for the military-industrial complex, for its survival, financial survival. That's also not a reason to go attack somebody, but this is what we're doing as a country. Really quite embarrassing on the world stage. Maybe providence will prevail through Trump, despite himself in this regard. Except that Seymour Hersh is reporting now as well, Trump approved strikes that will focus on key military and nuclear infrastructure, including the fortified Fardal facility, which is a give and take going on moment by moment. That is still unclear what's going on, and Trump makes it that way. I suppose you can say that's a decent strategy when you're at war with somebody, but he's supposedly not. And if he's going to be a peacemaker, I've said you don't do that. You don't create that sort of ambiguity, but he is. So we have peacemaker in word, but peacetaker in deed perfectly approximates a U.S. commander in chief flip-flopper, heavy on the flopper. But let's pray him better. I mean, much better. And perhaps in these days of wars and rumors of wars, it's also advisable to recognize the fuse may be lit for World War III sometime soon, but none of us have much that we can do to stop that lunacy. But if you are so inspired, a short but fervent daily prayer for peace might be a good idea. Let's intention peace, regardless of how bad it's sounding. It's very hard to find some good information. Everyone's lying like crazy where there is the fighting, but maybe let's pray for peace. Let's continue the good word daily and see if maybe we can get ourselves intentioning the world, intentions ourselves out of here. And going to the international law standards from the insight of someone else, other than Guy Behind Woodshed, extending the blanket of shame over the entire West, so-called. Europe's perverted logic, Israel has the right to attack, Iran is guilty for defending itself. But it's not actually logic, but criminal intent that I'm listening to. Not Europe's logic, it's they're in criminal intent, but that aside. European leaders have effectively blamed Iran for being attacked, responsible statecraft reports. Israel's strike violated Article 2, Subsection 4 of the UN Charter as it was launched with no legal basis for self-defense. And just remember what I said as well, the belligerent occupier has no right under international law of self-defense. But instead of condemning it, Europe parroted Israeli justifications. The claim that Iran is building nuclear weapons was dismissed by U.S. intelligence chief Tulsi Gabbard in March, saying, quote, Iran is not building a nuclear weapon. Still, EU leaders leaned on a June 2nd IAEA resolution accusing Iran of non-proliferation treaty violations to rationalize Israel's actions. And remember that right there, because I've got a big report coming here, hopefully in this broadcast. I should get to it. It's quite an extensive research that will discuss that very IAEA. And it's astonishing where the fingers of the culprits are. You know, we don't tend to really question those things. We tend to look at these authorities, and they're really just shows. They're just show, and we got to be very careful to not buy into it. I don't see many people resistant to that buy-in, but this is what I try and do behind Woodshed, is give us an insight so that we are, those of us that are paying attention. We can try and say we critically think, but we need the information to be able to think upon. We need it proper. We need to be able to trust it. And that's what they try to destroy. And that's what if you have your trust destroyed, you shouldn't extend it. In other words, I say you don't trust or have confidence in the government. That's their lifeblood. And we see the politics of any area, and we see how that's manipulated, and that's part of this story. The article goes on to ask, what do European leaders say? French President Emmanuel Macron, quote, France has repeatedly condemned Iran's ongoing nuclear program. And this, the program, no weapons here. You've got to keep track of this. It's a very important failure in all these statements, that they keep focusing on a nuclear program and get you to believe that they're talking about weapons, when a nuclear program, the nuclear capacity of the country, does so many more things. It's the nuclear weapons proliferation they want to control or regulate or whatever they see there. And it's retaliations that want to be controlled. You're not supposed to attack another one just because they want to do something with a nuclear device. In this context, France reaffirms Israel's right to defend itself and ensure its security. Now, this is said by a leader of France. He should know better, international law. Nobody uses this law. It's just a piece of paper, right? And this is why the paper does not enforce itself. We, the people, globally, have to enforce these things so that these madnesses don't get out of hand. But we also, I want to, as I said just before, we want to see France as a commercial nuclear power and a materials competitor, like the U.S. and the Zionista regimes, aren't they? And so this denial to Iran, where they do radiopharmacology nuclear products, would be right in line in what France would want to get rid of. No competition. German Chancellor Friedrich Merz, quote, Iran's nuclear program violates the provisions of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Isn't that interesting? There's no nuclear weapons there, just the program. We reaffirm that Israel has the right to defend its existence and the security of its citizens. EC President Ursula von der Leyen, quote, I reiterated Israel's right to defend itself and protect its people. So you have three people that are international law criminals, totally rejecting and attacking international law, which would keep peace, coming out of the mouths of these people that are in control of hundreds of millions of people, putting their lives at risk globally by these opinions. Now, how does non-weapon-making nuclear program violate the non-proliferation treaty, is what I would like to know. And does my listener see the terminological switcheroo? Germany references the nuclear program when the treaty only regards nuclear weapons. And the West, so-called, keeps flip-flopping on the pertinent subject matter. And furthermore, where we have pursuant to international law, does an illegal belligerent occupier, not just the Zionist regime, but any belligerent occupier, have a right to self-defense? Of course not. Neither of these problems proclaimed by Europe or its administrative commissions is referenced to any provision violating an international law as well. You didn't hear not one. Not one of those people reference anyone, anything in the international law. Because no illegal occupier has a right to self-defense. But the occupied people have right to resist, and without a weapon, there is no proliferation. Which, nevertheless, even if a violation, gives none of the countries more power than to complain to the relevant body, not a right to support or attack, whether in a group or unilaterally, as Israel began to do. Now calling Uncle, screaming Uncle right now, Uncle Sam, to come help it out of the mess that it just made. None of these leaders addressed the legality of Israel's initial strike. None acknowledged Iran's right to defend its own sovereignty. So Europe, nor J.D. Vance, in his uncritical word salad anti-embrace of the commander-in-chief flip-flopper, has any right. None whatsoever. But as I've shown, Trump nor Satan Yehu are interested in being constrained by law. And for those that turn away when I talk about Trump not being constrained or being wrong, look at what the court to come back relative to the law. It clearly violated by Trump every time. And then he's reluctant to come into compliance. And my main gripe, not all of them, I'm just talking about one, the due process. If you don't, as a listener, as someone in the United States, it really is anywhere, do not agree that your due process should not be taken. If you believe that he can take it, you really have to question whether or not, well, what kind of a mentality you are and whether you really want to be that American we talk about. Because I'm not talking really against Trump. I'm talking about these people that portray themselves as the officials. We have these elections, so-called, that put people in power. That our nation needs to have people that will follow the law. Otherwise, you are in that order of chaos that is being brought into a transformed future. You are taken down without any word right, like we see out of crumble. See rumble. No word at all. No warning. Just taken out. No different than the deportees that had a right of due process. Even some had a right to be here and are sitting in a prison in a country they now can't be taken back from. Or they're fighting to be returned. So it all follows that the U.S. loses the peace mask in the Israel-Iran crossfire. The U.S. is running the same old neocon playbook, now aimed at Iran. How will that pan out? Quote, this is a neocon agenda being played out, not a MAGA peace agenda, retired Lieutenant Colonel Karen Kiewatowski, ex-Pentagon analyst, tells Sputnik. And I did a little bit of research. This is a fairly decent lady here, it seems. I don't know too much more about it than what I could quite find quickly. She really doesn't like to see the corruption that's gone on. And I always have questions about these people, but I think she seems to be pretty straight up. So I'm going to go with the most, and I've been agreeable with what she comes up with and what she sees relative to my integrating with what I've found. So I'm going to go with her units, and I see a couple of different articles now coming out where she's now speaking out to explain things if we didn't understand. She's trying to do her analysis to help us, and I'm going to fairly agreeable with most of the stuff she's come up with. So I'm going to continue to use it. Unless you have another thing, send me an email to tell me so. Mark on the beast at proton.me, I think it is now, or proton.com. Anyway. Just get in touch with me, tell me how you see it different. But I'm going to go with this stuff until we find different. Quote, this is a neocon agenda being played out, not a MAGA peace agenda. As Israel's war machine escalates in Gaza and strikes Iran with U.S. support, the illusion of neutrality crumbles. Now remember that part, because this is what I mean, my complaint about it. This neutrality in the United States that Trump tries to create that he can't. He actually can't. And I think it's a big embarrassment, whether he wants to say so or not, that people see that he's not neutral. He shouldn't be at the tables as a mediator at all. And yet he tries to play that off. And you see, those things that he does that on really don't go very, very well. Trump's base may find this peacemaker branding impossible to square with the unfolding proxy war. The U.S. is already at war with Iran, just like in the Ukraine, it's a proxy fight. Without getting too detailed, I told you that it's not a proxy fight in Ukraine. It was a direct economic hit. When they made so many sanctions embargoes, you're at war. And so this happened coming right out of the gate, and I said that the first salvo of the sanctions was the loss. You lost right there. The United States lost. Ukraine lost. And they're just going to take now the slow motion of matter to move along and to solve that problem. Israel strikes don't happen without U.S. refueling, intel, and bombs. But what are the results? The complete elimination of any credibility Donald Trump and his administration have regarding peace and deals. And again, I don't want to get too critical. I just do want to make a clarity. Israel has tanker airplanes, but they're likely not enough. So they can do their own refueling, and they have, but it's not necessarily what they need, and that's part of why the United States is involved, which makes them a co-attacker. Like in Ukraine, expect no war declaration by the U.S., just more weapons to Israel and sanctions against Iran. The wild cards are global energy shocks and whether other nations seize the moment to confront Israel over its repeated regional offenses. And I just got to add, how many times have I been saying that the world, the nations of the world, and we heard the court case said not just that, but it was even the NGOs were to step up and stop this, and none of them have. So I'm not seeing this as much as a wild card, but anyway, it is there. So we'll go with that. But what about Israel's claim it rules over Iran's skies? That's good PR, not reality, according to Kwiatkowski. Houthis managed to temporarily shut down Ben-Gurion Airport. Eilat Port is bankrupt due to airstrikes. Quote, Israel may have created it for itself a self-fulfilling prophecy of an existential war. A boy crying wolf until one day the real wolf arrives and no one believes it. And no one saves the lying country, she concluded. So let's take a little note of that. Keep that in our hip pocket. This is BTWRLM 633. And then I want to go to a document tracked down. And this is somewhat of a verification of what Lieutenant Colonel Karen Kwiatkowski suggests we can find in a document entitled, Which Path to Persia? Options for a New American Strategy Toward Iran. Analysis paper was dated June 20, 2009. And we can turn to and read chapter 5. There's a big document here. You'll hear how far down the document goes and some of the numbers I'm going to call out. Not so you can keep track of where I'm at more quickly. But there's a whole bunch more behind this document that we can read from 2009. And the chapter 5 reads, Leave it to Bibi, allowing or encouraging an Israeli military strike. What should the United States do about Iran? When I looked at that, I said, what are you even bothered by Iran? They'll explain what they think they are bothered by, but it has to do with United States domination and dominance. But let's get to this article, into this. I wanted to read this part because, as we found in the great Comey swindle, universities were involved. They were planning the events, all that stuff, way back to 2010 or before. They had the item back in 2003. The CDC patented it to advance the great Comey swindle at warp speed, the bioweapon. And so this is the same type of paperwork that comes out. And again, thank you to people on the internet to search this stuff out, and I can search to find it myself, and we can get a better handle on what's going on and who is the actual actor here. We've been told that there's no light between the United States and Israel. Like, there's no light between the CIA and the Mossad. So understand that part. And this is, again, 2009. In a way, it's astonishing. Somehow you think that it's only a few years old that they were going to make a plan. No. This has been going on. All those reports I've reported on, those that before me came up and decided and showed where they were, this has been going on for decades and decades. So then you ask, well, back when, why did they become a problem? Well, I'm going to have a little bit of an insight about that. And we are talking about energy, too. And then we have the new addition, the rare earth minerals. The question is easily asked. For nearly 30 years, Washington has had difficulty coming up with a good answer. The Islamic Republic presents a particularly confounding series of challenges for the United States. I keep asking, why? Why just the United States? Why not any other country? And then I'm going to throw out a little bit here without going too deep. I've already talked to you about the connection back to where, how this country got started and what it really did in that peace treaty. And maybe why the United States has got the challenge. Many Iranian leaders regard the United States as their greatest enemy for ideological, nationalistic, and or security reasons, while a great many average Iranians evince the most pro-American feelings of any in the Muslim world. Perhaps not surprisingly, the track record of the U.S. policies toward Iran is not particularly impressive. Since 1979, Washington has tried everything from undeclared warfare to unilateral concessions. They just adjusted the law, so now Trump doesn't need a declaration of war. He just goes and does it because he feels threatened, national security and all. These policies have done better at limiting Iranian mischief, making than their critics will admit, but have largely failed to convince Tehran to drop its support for terrorist groups, its pursuit of nuclear weapons capability, and its wider efforts to overturn the regional status quo. And I just interject, see, this is, they're focused on the pursuit of nuclear weapons, and there's no evidence for it. So track this fiction right through this document as they keep focusing on these things. And why, this is like the reason for being, is the nuclear weapons, and that they have their pursuit of it. And there's no evidence for any of it. The problem of formulating an effective new U.S. policy toward Iran starts in Tehran. Since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, much of the Iranian leadership has harbored considerable antipathy toward the United States. Let me highlight this 1979 Islamic Revolution overthrow of who was before, and I'll get to that in a little bit. Remember how this who has what and what's going on. Ayatollah Sayyid Rahullah Mousavi Khomeini himself saw the world as a Manichaean struggle between good and evil. Iran standing as the champion of good and of Islam, synonymously concepts in his mind, but the United States as the champion of everything evil. This set of beliefs lay at the core of this thinking and become a foundational element of in the philosophy and claims of legitimacy of the regime. While there is no question that some Iranian leaders, most of the Iranian people would like better relations with the United States, this core belief continues to inspire others, often more powerful Iranian actors and institutions. The central purpose of this monograph is to try to prevent the most important policy options available to the United States to craft a new strategy toward Iran and to do so in a dispassionate, objective fashion. We would drop down to page 89, leave it to Bibi. Goal. As in the case of American airstrikes against Iran, the goal of this policy option should be to destroy key Iranian nuclear facilities in the hope that doing so would significantly delay Iran's acquisition of an indigenous nuclear weapons capability. However, in this case, an added element could be that the United States would encourage and perhaps even assist the Israelis in conducting the strikes themselves in the expectation that both international criticism and Iranian retaliation would be to deflect away from the United States and onto Israel. The logic behind this approach is that allowing Israel to mount the airstrikes rather than the United States provides a way out of the dilemma described in the previous chapter, whereby American airstrikes against Iran could become self-defeating because they would undermine every other American initiative in the Middle East, an outcome exactly opposite of what a new Iran policy is meant to accomplish. As with American airstrikes against the Iranian nuclear program, this option would be not entail any direct effort to deal with Iran's support for terrorists and radical groups, nor would it directly seek to mitigate other Iranian efforts to subvert the status quo in the Middle East. What status quo? Whose status quo? At most, this policy assumes Iran's ability to pursue such activities would be greatly enhanced by possession of a presumed nuclear weapons capability, and therefore that removing this threat would help limit Iran's ability to cause problems for the United States in the region. Well, that must be the status quo reasons, huh? The United States' interests only. Not so quick. Keep remembering that overthrow in 1979. Likewise, this approach makes no effort to change the Iranian regime or otherwise reshape its character. So let's look at that, exactly what's in the news, but we see that the opposite's happening. And this is where we can depart a bit from this 2009 report and policy manual to now, where there is already talk of doing regime change, though that is couched not as an object, but as a consequence. But that will be neither here nor there relative to that point. Despite that the document does discuss regime change later, to say there are several ways in which the United States could change the regime or undermine it. Supporting a popular revolution, stirring up Iran's ethnic groups, or promoting a coup Where'd they do that before, folks? Where'd they promote a coup? We actually got it. In practice, these options could be pursued simultaneously and overlap in some of their elements, but it is worth considering each separately to understand their nature and requirements. And so right in the document, the same report, they do offer a regime change option. It's just not for Bibi to do, apparently. But now you hear Bibi doing it. This appears to be the basis for the plans today that Trump and Netanyahu are following. They get all come together and they want to plan. No, this is already, they pull out chapter 5 and they started working from it. Now go to page 94, the overview of the policy if the U.S. decides to leave it to Bibi. An Israeli air campaign against Iran would have a number of very important differences from an American campaign. First, the Israeli Air Force, IAF, has the problem of overflight transit from Israel to Iran. Israel has no aircraft carriers, so its planes must take off from Israeli air bases. It also does not possess long-range bombers like the B-1 or B-2 or huge fleets of refueling tankers, all of which means that unlike the United States, Israel cannot avoid flying through someone's airspace. The most direct route from Israel to Iran's Natanz facility is roughly 1,750 kilometers across Jordan and Iraq. And the king of Jordan has allowed that, and that's kind of getting everybody else riled up. They'll stop the Iranian missiles, but they'll allow Israel to go transit their airspace. And so we're seeing a fracture built in, and don't forget, that's part of the plan too. Keep the whole Middle East fractured so that there's no integration. Right now, Iran is the most powerful integrated nation. As the occupying power in Iraq, the United States is responsible for defending Iraqi airspace. The alternative via Turkish airspace, over 2,200 kilometers, or Saudi airspace, over 2,400 kilometers, would also put the attack force into the skies of the U.S. allies equipped with American-supplied air defenses and fighter aircraft. Again, play this out in what you're hearing in the news. All of this stuff. Almost like coming right out of this paper with some adjustments. In the case of Turkey, an Israeli overflight would further be complicated by the fact that Turkey is a NATO ally that the United States has a commitment to defend, and it hosts a large joint Turkish-American air base along the most likely route of attack. For political and military reasons, Israel's need to overfly Turkish, Iraqi, Jordanian, or Saudi airspace creates two problems. First, an Israeli strike must achieve surprise so the Israeli planes are not intercepted by the air defenses and fighters of those other countries. Second, in part based on reason number one, the Israelis would get basically one shot at Iran. On the first pass, they likely would surprise any of those countries and be able to reach Iran and return before the Turks, Saudis, and Jordanians could activate their air defenses. But a second wave would meet alerted air defenses, creating military and political problems that Israel would likely find insurmountable. Again, let me bring up to date 2009. That's what they had as a problem. They've been spending all this time to work a lot of that out if we hear the news today. An initial Israeli attack across Iraqi territory would severely complicate the U.S. military presence there, and repeat performance would likely compromise it altogether. Thus, after the first round of strikes, Israel would have nothing but its small fleet of ballistic missiles and a submarine-launched cruise missile for follow-up attacks. Because the ballistic missiles are such a valuable asset, Jerusalem would not likely squander them on anything but the highest value Iranian targets. And another problem Israel faces is distance. The IAF possesses 25 F-15I long-range strike aircraft, which have a combat radius of over 2,500 kilometers, giving them the range to hit Iranian targets even if they have to fly via Turkey or Saudi Arabia. However, 25 aircraft is a tiny number given the size, dispersal, and hardening of the Iranian nuclear program, especially since the planes could not carry much ordnance, nor would they have the ability to hit multiple facilities on a large single sortie at that distance. So Israel's F-15I fleet alone could not hope to do as much damage to the Iranian nuclear program as even the small-scale American airstrikes discussed in the previous chapter. Then we move up to today just to move this through. We have the F-35 now, which we now almost see why Israel has so many. This was all part of this as well. I think they realized it's not going to do it. We need better capability. So they started to stock up. Thus, just employing the 25 F-15I probably would not make the operation worthwhile from Jerusalem or Washington's perspective. In addition to the F-15s, Israel has acquired 100 F-16I fighter bombers. There is a great deal of speculation regarding the combat range of the F-16I, which most sources suggest is roughly 1,600 to 1,800 kilometers. Consequently, in most scenarios for Israel to mount an airstrike of any size against Iran, assuming that Israel cannot secretly refuel its aircraft at an airbase near Iran, it would have to provide in-flight refueling to enable the F-16s to participate. The IAF would have virtually no capability to conduct opportunity strikes on targets revealed by Iranian actions during the attacks themselves, nor would it have much, if any, ability to follow up with repeat strikes to hit facilities where the initial attack failed to destroy the targets. Overall, an Israeli strike would be even less likely to meaningfully set back the Iranian nuclear program than would an American campaign. An Israeli attack on Iran versus a U.S. interest, an Israeli attack on Iran would directly affect key American strategic interests. If Israel were to overfly Iraq, both the Iranians and the vast majority of people around the world would see the strike as abetted, if not authorized, by the United States. And so this gets us right back to where Trump's being very careful, and what the United States did is backed off to say that they were not going to help Israel. You heard that repeatedly. This is the main thing. Again, playing this 2009 plan out. In fact, $3 billion in U.S. assistance annually sustains the IDF's conventional superiority in the region. So again, without the United States, Israel does nothing. The Israelis are well aware of the risks and downsides of an attack on Iran's nuclear facilities, especially the possible cost in American lives if Tehran retaliates against the United States. Given these risks, Jerusalem may focus on strengthening sanctions in the near term, but the Israelis may feel compelled to act if they judge that the current administration's diplomatic push has failed. Isn't that both at play right now? And isn't this the headline news? Is Netanyahu not listening to Trump? Is Trump being played? Is playing Netanyahu? That's that paragraph right there. Moving to page 98, the pros and cons. The following are the advantages and disadvantages of the Israeli approach. Advantages. As noted, the most salient advantage this option has over that of an American air campaign is that the possibility that Israel alone would be blamed for the attack. If this proves true, this is an advantage, it's a question. If this proves true, then the United States might not have to deal with Iranian retaliation or the diplomatic backlash that would accompany an American military operation against Iran. That would accompany an American military operation against Iran, stated in 2009. This is not the latest. This is not the first either. It could allow Washington to have its cake, delay Iran's acquisition of nuclear weapons, and eat it too, avoiding undermining many of U.S. regional diplomatic initiatives. Israeli forces might be able to execute the attack much sooner and with much less prior notice and preparation than American military forces could. It would presumably be easier to convince Israel to mount the attack than it would be to generate domestic political support for another war in the Middle East, let alone the diplomatic support from a region that is extremely wary of new American military adventures. This was in 2009, they say they were worried. How wary do you think that place is now? At least some of the important Israelis want to conduct such an attack and would welcome Washington's encouragement. And we've heard that as well in the news. Other Israelis are less enthusiastic but feel it may be necessary if they believe they have no choice, and they, too, would be far more willing to attack if they believe that the United States was firmly behind it. disadvantages. An Israeli airstrike against Iran entails all of the same disadvantages as an American air campaign against Iran, but has few of its advantages. Its one advantage, the possibility that Iran would bear the entire burden for the strike in terms of international opprobrium and Iranian retaliation, is highly uncertain and would depend on the circumstances of the strike and a variety of unpredictable perceptions. If the United States is seen as ultimate or jointly responsible for the attack, there would be no advantage from the American perspective. And you're hearing that actually going ahead, and they're going to concede that, I think, if Trump wants to go in. Whether or not that's a play, I don't know. We'll have to find out. In particular, an Israeli military airstrike would be weaker than even a limited American air campaign, and so would have to lower likelihood they seriously delaying Iran's acquisition of a nuclear weapons capability. Thus, when assessing the American cost-benefit analysis of this option, the benefit is unquestionably less than it would be if the United States mounted an attack itself, while any reduction in costs would be extremely difficult to assess and could be marginal or non-existent. Now, I said somewhat of a verification here because there has been some modifications in the execution, as I'm mentioning as we went through this and before. They're adopting most of this chapter to better try to mitigate the negative aspects found then. Over the years, they were working to do that. So this chapter wouldn't necessarily look directly in play if taken without the further considerations. But it appears the United States has opted to execute a modified Chapter 5 attack, as the United States functionaries also attempt, pursuant to the analysis, to put public distance between it and the Zionist regime. Exactly 16 years to the month hence that 2009 intelligence analysis was done, the distance away from the regime, the proximity of which the United States also says there is no light between. And so how you correlate that is pretty interesting. We've not pulled them real up tight and close, but then they try to do the separation. And so it makes it a lot more difficult. And I just would assume the worst and say they're one. They're just one entity. This playbook says the United States is using Israel for its U.S. interests. And yet it's not just that either. Here's more evidence of Mossad's. And if we go to the facts exposed in the recent JFK files together with the James Jesus Appleton CIA Mossad affair, likely the CIA fingers in Ukraine's attack on Russia, citing the attack on Iran, Mossad's sabotage playbook, how Iran can fight back. Israel's operations in Iran follows a clear playbook for dealing with sabotage. Andrei Popov, retired FSB lieutenant colonel and veteran of the Alpha Counterterrorism Special Forces Unit, explains the tactics to defeat these attacks. Spiderweb tactics. Israel's approach mirrors Ukraine's spiderweb tactics, decentralized attacks using sleepy drones and hidden logistics networks. These drones can lie dormant for years, activated through shipping loopholes or modified vehicles. What matters most? Identifying countries, groups, or individuals with terrorist intentions toward the state. After that, intelligence services work to infiltrate those countries, terrorist structures, and organizations. And for those of you that don't think you may be considered a terrorist organization or a part of a terrorist organization or structure, look at your Patriot Act and what the future that they want, the digital gulag, the Siberian gulag, is all about. This enables them to gather information on planned operations. So what matters most is identifying groups or individuals with terrorist intentions toward the state. And that would be anything that the state doesn't like. I can just tell you that. It won't be limited. Just as Loomer called to be put in place, and Trump is allowing ICE to gather information, including that of coming and going of Americans, not foreigners, and Congress is proposing with Palantir. Remember, Trump is not doing Palantir. Congress will bring it in. It's the law. That becomes now the set foundation. And aside that, relative to identifying subversive groups, what is the Mossad doing attacking Russia if the U.S. is not also involved, is the clue the U.S. has been already at war with Iran if the direct attacks on Yemen weren't another clue. This also means that Trump's word, other than deception, Trump's word means really nothing. And despite my hope, beyond hope, that Trump could be more than a fictional WWE SmackDown wrestler, the Manhattan Mauler, that Trump has disgraced himself and America on the world stage, and there was no reason for it. Despite Trump's P.T. Barnum-esque promotions to step right up and see the global peacemaker end two wars in 2 minutes, he now has continued and brought into the spotlight a third ongoing war with Iran through the proxy of the Zio terrorist state, and for no valid reason that I can see, none whatsoever. People argue that this shows Zionists aren't in control of the United States administration, but that doesn't hold water. Being the chosen, it's nothing to infiltrate and set up a condition to have Israeli soldiers replaced by American soldiers or sailors. Remember, it was the U.S. aviators put in harm's way that struck Yemen, the Houthis of which have been retaliating against the Palestinian genocide, and of which the genocide apparently is a U.S. interest. And we hear the soon-to-be-decommissioned and scrapped USS Nimitz being directed to the Middle East, close enough for it to be USS Libertied, whether by false flag or Iran hits it with a hypersonic ship killer in order for Trump to get the U.S. openly directly involved, if needed. Trump's rhetoric is pointing to that already as we listen. Again, when we see that plan and we see this what's being said, it's almost like, there it is. And then we attach the Israeli playbook on top, and here it is. It's all coming together. It also appears that Trump's stated desire to end forever wars is being fulfilled as he appears to be trying to get rid of entire nations of people quickly, eliminating the need of the use of forever wars to establish greater Zionism. In identifying countries, groups, or individuals with terroristic intentions toward the state, civilian tips are key. 80% of the plots are uncovered through human intelligence. Hunters, villagers, the truck drivers spotting unusual activity are more reliable than expensive surveillance. Quote, this is an on-the-ground work. Work with the local population, the intel veteran explained. It's about a system. Only a coordinated counterintelligence system can effectively counter-sabotage operations like Spiderweb. A system is what enables detection. You infiltrate before you strike. Agents map entire logistic chains, tracking suspicious containers and modified vehicles. And make no mistake, the enemy is unlikely to repeat the same kind of tactics, Popov emphasized. That new attacks will come is no longer in doubt. The only question is what new tactics they'll use next. They focus on logistics as well. Start by identifying how drones would enter the country, develop algorithms to trace their origins and deliver routes, plus monitor electronics purchases that would indicate drone production. Let me just add, what do you think starts happening when the Russian government puts the app on every phone? When every interaction needs to be digitized, this is what's going on there. They're looking to do this, which is admirable, but what about all the people that don't need to come underneath it? And for good measure, Israel's shock and awe on Iran, right out of the U.S. playbook, just like that, because there's no light between the United States ruling uniparty regime and Israel, and except that it didn't actually incapacitate or render Iran ineffective, and of which was closely followed by the unwarranted U.S. peacemaker president's direct threats to the entire population of Tehran, a city larger than New York City, ordering their immediate evacuation, coming from the only nation to twice use nuclear weapons against entire city populations. It cannot be said that this is an idle threat from him, as Trump also posted on Truth Social, claiming that the U.S. now had unobstructed primacy in Iranian airspace, meaning that the U.S. jets had unchallenged primacy in that airspace. And just after that threat, the feeds were populated with the nuclear-capable B-2 Spirit stealth bomber pictures. What is this B-2 Spirit that is summoned by the one calling himself a peacemaker while unwarranted and lawless threats of annihilation are made against a population of innocent people? Maybe it's the Beelzebub 2 spirit. And to pick up on the resilience of Iran, as the Zionist shock and awe playbook attack hits them, and bringing into a geopolitical perspective one more element into the importance of taking out Iran in the changing economic global parity, restructuring and control of oil and other production, the likely reason for the 1953 CIA and MI6 coup against the nationalist Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, who took state control of British oil interests, which was a big no-no, and likely what the King of England wants back from the Iranians, if not that alone, now as well, rare earths and other mineral controls. And need I remind you who it was that gave sanction to allow the Zionist Federation movement to the ability to illegally and belligerently occupy Palestine, but Britain, and wrongly aided and abetted by most of the rest of the world through the UN. That the heir apparent to the U.S. coup of Iran, though it's not supposed to be doing that, the regime change, the heir apparent is already standing in the wings, being promoted. His name is Reza Pahlavi, and he's living right there in Washington, D.C., if reports are true. He's the son of Iran's last royal leader, the Shah, who was toppled in the 1979 Islamic Revolution, who was installed in Iran in 1953. Iran now first line of defense of BRICS and the Global South. So if you've tied, listen to my broadcast, you've been seeing me tie together all these elements, the economic, the production, the sovereignty, they want to call it, the integration with the sustainable development. It all ends up coming back together. Who are the base interests that are involved? The king is right back in here. And so attacking this is attacking that competitor, if you will. But it's all to bring parity. So don't forget on this. Israeli shock and awe in Iran, straight from the trade book, U.S. playbook. This trademark U.S. playbook, as we were reading, essentially failed despite the initial combination of speed, meticulous military planning, and the element of surprise, including hacking the Iranian electronic communications within the military grid, decapitation of the vertical IRCG nomenclatura, and the spiderweb drone attack playbook, and bombing ultimately ineffectual of key nodes of the Iranian nuclear infrastructure. It took hours for top Iranian technicians to get their grid back. And once that happened, the tide began to turn to the point that after the surgical missile volleys deep in the night of Sunday, the IRGC announced its capability to seriously disrupt Israel's command and control systems using enhanced intelligence, thus breaching Iran or Paper Dome. Absolutely key infrastructure nodes in Tel Aviv and Haifa have been destroyed. From the Rafael weapons complex, specialized in missile drones and cyber warfare and Iron Dome components, to the power plant and oil refinery in Haifa. This is historic in more ways than one. Compound the cries of joy all across the lands of Islam to the massive psychological trauma inflicted on Israel. The myth of Israel invincibility has definitely been shattered. And remember that report, they pointed out that the limited capability of Israel to be able to pull that off anyway. And even with the improvements since 2009, it apparently wasn't enough. I'll have to interject. Likely, this is why the peacemaker Trump came out to embarrass himself, essentially, and the nation, to directly threaten Tehran to take the focus off the shattered Zionist invisibility as well. All of a sudden, now he's taking the mantle that he's gonna do it, but he really hasn't followed through there. As we read a little bit on that plan, that policy analysis, it's not so easy. The myth of Israeli invincibility has been definitely shattered, unleashing hell from above, killing women and children, and spinning like there's no tomorrow does not win a war against a real opponent. The tweaked IRGC strategies are applied by an instantly revamped leadership. It's being fine-tuned day by day in a calculated surgical manner. It's not that hard for the IRGC to totally paralyze Israel's economy. Israel has only one oil refinery already bombed, three ports, of which one is already bankrupt, that's the Eilat, and another is on fire at Haifa, and one airport already in dire straits. The blowback of Tel Aviv's desperate, indeed suicidal move, no chess involved, is in effect. Tehran is proving that every Zionist Axis calculation that Iran could and was bled dry in a matter of hours was predictably false. The President of the United States, for his part, fell into a voracious trap. His MAGA base is already fractured in depth. Non-Zionist MAGA is the overwhelming majority. He admitted in a stunning infantilist post that he knew everything about Israeli shock and awe all along. In a trap here that of the Manhattan Mahler's own not too terrific, not beautiful making, because he knew. As I've said in the previous episodes, Trump's a deceiver. He's a liar. He didn't have to be. He didn't and likely won't rise above to become the type of man he claimed he intended to be. No, until this point, old Saint Nick Ear is riding shotgun with the devil in the synagogue of Satan, or at least the Satan Yehu. Less than 10 days ago, in a meeting in New York packed with billionaires' usual suspects, Steve Witkoff himself, Trump's Talleyrand, explicitly noted that Iranian ballistic missiles are a threat to America. Now we hear the hype coming. Considering their performance in the last 48 hours, everything points to Washington de facto entering the hot war. Well, the report said so, didn't it? The report said that would be the danger if they couldn't pull it off. Well, now they've embraced it. Well, so the way I see it, considering Yemen and the help of Britain, not just entering, but continuing the hot war. Diplomatic sources of Tehran point out that the leadership is working under this scenario. That's why they are essentially still holding their capabilities and carefully calibrating the next big steps in the escalatory ladder. Once again, Iranian strategy patience is on display. Persian pride and trust in their own capabilities, as I was observed last month in Iran, this is the writer, rules that they consider to have all the necessary resources to outlast the Zionist Axis, U.S. included. And I've heard today that people are complaining, why didn't they go to China and Russia? Iran said, we don't need it right now. Thank you. When we need it, we'll ask. And interestingly, three big giant military cargo planes showed up from China, turned off their identifiers or transponders, and no one knows what was in those things, so there might be some more going on. They're feeling pretty confident. They're getting some support. After all, they are only now starting to use their really advanced missiles from the Kbar Shikhan 2 and the Fatah 1 to the Hajin Qassam. The real war against the BRICS is what this is really after here. Again, we look at the dynamic of the parity and who controls that and who's going to be moving that through. In a nutshell, the Iranian response turned the chessboard completely upside down. The circus ringmaster, complete with hosting and pathetic military parade in Washington, is naked and unmasked. Now, didn't I just note unmasked the three-ring circus distraction last episode? Right here in the news this week. He now owns not one but two proxy wars against Russia and against Iran, with neo-Nazis in Kiev and genocidals in Tel Aviv on the front lines, all part of the big picture war against BRICS. By now it's clear even for the deaf, dumb, and blind that this was never about the Iranian nuclear program or the effort to construct a Trump-owned JCPOA 2.0. Remember, that was the one that Trump killed, and then Iran even agreed to a different agreement that Trump did not take. To understand the dynamic of how this works on through, to point out 2009 analysis is being played right now. There's no intention to make peace. It's about the lifelong Zionist Axis obsession, regime change in Tehran. This is the Holy Grail, dreamed of since late 1990s, capable of opening the door for a deeply troubled empire of chaos of Iran's immense wealth in natural resources, from energy to rare earth deposits, thus prolonging the life in the multi-trillion-dollar indebted empire. The extra bonuses are even more seductive. Cutting off China from a matter of national security energy imports and from crucial new Silk Road connectivity corridors in tandem with opening a monster abscess in Russia's underbelly. A definitive trifecta blow in one swoop to three top BRICS, Iran, Russia, and China, to Eurasia integration and to drive towards a multinodal, multipolar system of international relations, even as top civilization states are doing somersaults to outlast the empire chaos and its master's drive to unleash World War III, there are no illusions in Moscow and Beijing that to confront this scenario, it's imperative to act asymmetrically, with supreme cunning instead of merely responding to provocations, which have been the predominant Russian playbook in the proxy war in Ukraine. Why Iran must not be allowed to fail? Of course, the current insane escalatory ladder would be non-existent if Trump had been mature enough to accept the offer by Ali Shakhanani. Later assassinated by Israel, Iran could get rid of the highly enriched uranium and sign a nuclear deal if sanctions were lifted. Tehran would then only enrich uranium at lower levels for its civilian population. In parallel, Tehran had also even suggested a joint nuclear enrichment project with U.S. investment plus Saudi Arabia and UAE. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi personally outlined it to U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff in Oman before the talks broke down. And it's just been reported that that gentleman had an assassination attempt on him. The Global South, meanwhile, watches the horrendous deadly ping-pong between Israel and Iran with increasing awareness that the cornered West is an even more dangerous animal day after day, waging total war under the mask of peace. Tel Aviv burning is the beginning of a new era of Israel. In their rage, they now threaten the Beirut model of Tehran, wanton destruction of civilian neighborhoods, once again, what they do best, terrorism. Consequences will be inevitably discussed in this week's St. Petersburg Economic Forum, all the way to Putin's address at the plenary session on Friday, and all the way to the BRICS summit in Rio de Janeiro in early July. Taking the pulse of the Global South, the feeling is that Iran de facto is in the process of restoring ethics and geopolitical authority all across West Asia as the Persian Empire exercised it for centuries. That's what civilization states do. Their role as privileged guardians of their sphere of influence is always essential. From Nigeria to Indonesia to Vietnam, BRICS members and BRICS partners, there's a growing consensus that Iran must not be allowed to fall. It's that serious. The spell of unrestricted Westcraft diktat has finally been broken. All that will survive is the loud lament of the disconsolate chimera. It takes a failed shock and awe to break the camel's back. As I've titled a previous Behind a Woodshed episode, Let Them Eat Chaos, identifying this very point on what's going on in the world as imposed by the United States, but it's not the end. If you see, they rise to the Global South, but it's to bring the South in parity for the global financial system. And so it continues while the ultimate intended order that they want is being established with Trump's help. And if I suspend my disbelief for 3 seconds, it can't be made great again. Not like this, anyway, if it can be at all. And having to suspend my disbelief that Iran could defend itself, at least based on initial reports such as that Iran lost air superiority of its Western Front, and despite it being reported in the past that Iran had focused its efforts on defense, developing its air defense system over the last 40 years, just planned for this incursion that I've been reading, and losing many of the top echelon military and senior nuclear scientists in the first strikes, while the Zionist regime attacked Tehran's both civilians and militarily, with impunity it seemed, Iran strikes Israeli air bases. On June 13th, Israel launched a large-scale operation dubbed Rising Lion, saying it struck military targets and facilities of Iran's nuclear program, the Israeli Air Force carried out several waves of attacks across Iran, including Tehran, killing several senior Iranian military officials, as well as several nuclear scientists. Iran retaliated by launching Operation True Promise 3 later in the evening that hit military targets inside Israel. During this 10th wave, an operation was carried out using a large number of missiles on the air bases of the Zionist regime army from where their fighters fly out towards our country, the IRGC said in a statement and quoted by Iran's state broadcaster. Now, far be it for me to think I understand the defense positions better than the Persian generals in defending their country, but being the Zionist terrorist is attacking and likely can only attack by the air, wouldn't you think it was imperative to destroy those air bases and support facilities in the first to third waves rather than waiting until the 10th so it could not continue to be effective in its strikes? So we'll have to see what develops. But Iran seemed to be in a bad way early on while they started in their promotions, they started to mimic Baghdad Bob. And now it sounds like the U.S. is rattling its saber for direct involvement, given Netanyahu already admitted Israel cannot take out the nuclear facilities on its own without the U.S. bunker-busting bombs, which we heard in 2009. They knew that. And throwing out that 2009 analysis for the U.S. to maintain plausible deniability in attacking Iran now, we also can find out that it isn't about the nuclear weapons that they claim to be after, which, by the by, Iran has a right to under international law. Not actually about nuclear at all here, but it is regime change. And we just kind of have to think, that's so democratic, right? So democratic. Such is this concentrated evil. And we see war underneath the name of peace. The United States government, Department of War name was changed to Department of Defense. This is the same game that's been going on since the United States has ever been existing. Now, my concern about Iran's failure to immediately stop the air campaign to protect its population is heightened when it might be that Baghdad Bob lives in Iran, or to believe the rhetoric that the U.S. is not directly involved when I hear Trump demands unconditional surrender from Iran. Now, this is the peacemaker now. The United States not getting involved, and Trump comes on and demands unconditional surrender from Iran. Iran's skies are under the total control of the U.S. and its allies, the American president has claimed. Now, wait. How can Trump demand surrender when the U.S. peacemaker is not directly at war with Iran? United States President Donald Trump has demanded an unconditional surrender from Iran, which has been locked in a heated military conflict with Israel over the past days. In a series of posts on his Truth Social, Trump also claimed that, quote, we now have complete and total control of the skies over Iran. Hostilities between the West, Jerusalem, and Tehran have been intensifying since Israel's attack on the Uranium Enrichment Center, nuclear and military facilities, and series of drones and car bomb attacks that killed over a dozen senior Iranian military commanders and scientists, as well as military civilians. Let me add, if you've seen some of these pictures, you tell me where Israel can attack their commanders in an apartment complex with a hole in the wall by a missile to take out a military commander. Why didn't they do that in Gaza? Why did they drop entire skyscrapers of buildings and apartments? Anyway, move on. Iran retaliated by firing dozens of ballistic missiles into Israel. The two sides have been exchanging attacks since then. Unconditional surrender, Trump wrote, is in capital letters on the Truth Social on Tuesday. Now, this is the posts of a lunatic. Besides, who is the Manhattan Mauler, the business agent for? Surrender to whom, exactly? Or was that the WWE Manhattan Mauler saying he was throwing in the towel that he unconditionally surrendered? The American president also issued a direct threat against the Islamic Republic's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, claiming that the U.S. and its Israeli allies know exactly where Khamenei is hiding. Trump called him an easy target, but stated that we are not going to take him out, at least for now. So this is the threat of a madman. But as I asked last week, who is this we? Does Deceiver Don have a rat in his pocket? Or is Trump the ventriloquist dummy? Quote, our patience is wearing thin, the U.S. president added. Speaking to journalists early on Tuesday, the American leader said that his goals in the conflict between West Jerusalem and Tehran go beyond a ceasefire, adding that he wanted Iran to forego entirely on nuclear weapons. Now, who is our? Or is this evidence of a multiple personality disorder? At any rate, Iranians already agreed to not have nuclear weapons and limit enrichment to 3.5% for civilian reactor purposes. Then we had the entire Iranian negotiating team assassinated. So this assertion by Trump is a lie, because this entire ruse is not about nuclear weapons, but regime change, when, for now, is up. Tehran signaled on Tuesday that it was ready to continue fighting. Quote, the enemy cannot sustain a long war as it continues. The back of the Zionist regime will be broken. Iran's defense ministry spokesman Brigadier General Reza Zalayuknik said in a televised interview that aired an Iranian state broadcaster that the general also announced that the use of new missile systems as part of the retaliatory strikes. Quote, today we've used one of our missiles for the first time, and the Zionist regime didn't even realize it had been deployed. They will see more of these surprises, he said. And that actually is it's a missile that goes out into the atmosphere and comes back in. I think it's the one that they're actually using for sending up their satellites as well. Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard, IRGC, reported a successful strikes on Israeli military intelligence logistics headquarters and a Mossad intelligence center in Tel Aviv area on Tuesday. In fact, the 8200 operation's been hit hard. And so we'll see how that affects maybe our ex-Twitters. Maybe they'll clean up a bit. The targets were hit despite the presence of highly advanced defense systems, it said. This also indicates this war won't be shortened unless American airmen are put in harm's way, it seems to me, and for an unjust cause. West Jerusalem justified its Friday attack by claiming Iran was on the brink of obtaining a nuclear weapon. Again, international law doesn't provide for them to attack or determine the brink, and that's not how that gets settled anyway. But that that's not a justification. Even if the Zionist regime didn't have nuclear weapons itself. Remember that. Tehran has repeatedly denied such accusations, maintaining that its nuclear program is entirely peaceful. In late March, U.S. National Intelligence Director Tulsi Gabbard stated the American intelligence data suggests Iran was not building a nuclear weapon and its nuclear arms program had been on hold since 2003. When asked about this assessment on Tuesday, Trump stated that he did not care what she said. So I wonder, what intelligence is Trump using? Any intelligence working at all? And sounding like Trump is very much on the 2009 Neo-Ziocon plan and never intended to be a peacemaker. Quote, someone please explain to crazy Tucker Carlson that Iran cannot have nuclear weapons. Trump. The America First honeymoon is ending. The harsh everyday life of the usual American aggression begins. Earlier, Carlson, in an interview with Bannon, directly accused Trump of selling MAGA for Israel. I am making this statement because we are being dragged into this. We may witness the end of the American empire. This could effectively end the Trump presidency. I saw it happen to George W. Bush and Iraq. The fact that this is being said publicly, transparently, hints that the decision on the United States attack on Iran has already been made and is in the near future. I can also assume that the public conflict with Musk was also due to the already made decision to attack Iran. Notice Trump says weapon. He wants unconditional surrender where there is no nuclear weapon. Despite the lack of evidence of nuclear weapons, Trump misdirects his bloodlust at nuclear facilities that there is evidence to prove are doing only peaceful nuclear projects. So someone tell Trump Iran doesn't have nuclear weapons and international law recognizes lawful civilian use of nuclear energy. So Carlson doesn't need to be told. What Carlson needs to be told is we don't want an American empire. I thought we lived in that constitutional republic. This has been BTW RLM 633, and I'll be with you next week. Tech tips for nature willing.
Echoes call, the hour is near. Behind the woodshed, the truth you'll hear. Every Sunday, the clock strikes three. Hal's voice rolls like thunder, fierce and free. Pull up a chair, lean in close, listen to learn. Dose by dose, behind the woodshed.
Next week, heed the call. Behind the woodshed, standing tall.